With 60 years in show business as a professional entertainer on stage and television, a string of hit records in the 1960s, Ken Dodd has not stopped entertaining since he turned professional in 1954. So I'm tremendously tickled to be talking to the Squire of Knotty Ash, the King of the Diddy Mend. It's the living legend that is Ken Dodd OBE. Good afternoon, Ken.
By Jove, young man, you'll wear your mouth out.
I know.
Well, it's out. Good gracious, what sort of pills are you on?
I've got to let you do some of the talking. How are you, Ken?
Hey, I'm fine. I'm quite fizzing like a bottle of pop with the cork out.
Oh, I'm glad to hear it.
Bad. Yeah, so everything's fine. I'm here in Knotty Ash.
Well, I hope
we're doing very well. The Jambutty mines are doing very well, and the Broken Biscuit repair works, as you know.
Oh, good. Oh, well, I've got a question from a listener about that later on. I hope the weather's a bit better in Knotty Ash than it is here. It's absolutely grim.
It's dry for the moment. Yeah, very windy.
Yeah,
it's a draft around the back door.
Oh dear, we can't have that. This is a bit like two-way family favourites, isn't it? Do you remember that?
Oh yes. You don't sound like Judith Chalmers, though.
Oh no, not at all. No.
Hello, Judith. What's the weather like where you are?
Now, is that right that you still live in the same house in which you were born in the Liverpool suburb of Knotty Ash?
Well, yes. It's a lovely old Georgian, a bit like a farmhouse, you know. But it's very nice. It's got quite a few rooms in it, and every room is different.
Right.
You know, it's not predictable. So if you have a bit of a row in one room, you can go into another room and sulk.
Very handy, yes. Yeah. So you've been there since you were born. What was your childhood like, Ken?
Oh, very happy.
Yeah.
I think anybody who's had a nice family life, and everybody who's had a brother and a sister, and plenty of room to run around and play cowboys and Indians, I think you've had a marvellous start to your life. Wonderful. It really is a great. I didn't realise how important and how well off I was until a few years ago. When you grow up and you look back over your life, you think, my God, they were good days, those.
Yeah, yeah. So what kind of kid were you?
My hobbies were climbing trees, digging holes, and setting fire to my coat. I seem to spend a whole life doing that and getting filthy dirty and grazing your knees.
Yeah.
Sounds... You only wore short trousers. Did you wear short trousers?
All the time, yeah. I still do sometimes, yeah.
You still do?
Yeah.
Oh, God, that's a bit strong, that. Oh, dear. Did he put up with that down south anyway? Of course, you're an Essex lad, aren't you?
Oh, yes. Well, what do you think about coming to Essex? You've been here before, haven't
many,
you?
Many, many times. Lovely. Yeah. It's one of my favourite theatres. Yeah. A theatre is really... It's a building, and it becomes a theatre when there's people, when there's an audience there, and your memories of it are usually governed by the kind of people, and they're very, very enthusiastic at Southend, very, very lively.
Sure.
Yeah, that's the word, I think. Yeah.
Now, you discovered very early on that you wanted a career in entertainment. When was your very first paid show?
Ah, well, that was it. That turned me on. In those days... Well, I'd like little boys are mostly interested in magic and magicians. I think I'd be a bit too clumsy to be a magician.
Yeah.
So I went in for ventriloquism, didn't I?
Yeah.
Dickie Mint.
Dickie Mint. Yeah.
Well.
So my first show, I did a show at Christmas. I think it was a Christmas day at an orphanage about half a mile from here.
Right.
And the poor little beggars, they were stuck with me, weren't they? They couldn't get out. Anyway, I did my act. And the Father Superior, who ran the place, the head priest, he called me into his office. I thought he was going to give me a good hiding, but he didn't. He gave me half a crown.
Right.
And so I'd tasted money, you see.
And how old were you then?
About eight.
About eight. Nine. Now, you know, it's astounding.
Yeah. I started playing the... anywhere where there's an audience, anybody who'd listen to me, I'd go around doing a match with Dickie Mint, didn't I?
Yeah.
Right. And we've been together ever since.
So though you turned professional in 1954, you've actually been entertaining over nine decades.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's astounding.
I've had my apprenticeship, which I think every entertainer should.
Yeah.
Going around the social clubs, you know, all the different the clubs, the British Legions and that.
Yeah.
Because in those days there were great audiences.
Yeah.
They liked a drink or two, but they'd always listen to you, which is very important.
Good. Yeah. Yeah. Did your mum and dad encourage you to go into?
Yeah, very much so. Yeah.
Yeah.
My mother used to pack my case for me when I'd been doing the show, and then she'd say to me, she'd make at the front door, she'd say, "Now, Kenny, I don't care where you go, as long as you wear a clean shirt." And my dad used to make all my props for me. Yeah, absolutely wonderful. You don't realise it at the time, but if you had a, did you have a nice mother and father?
Oh, I had a lovely mum and dad. Yeah.
If you get, if you've got a nice mum and dad, you've got, it's like building a house. You've got the foundations of a great life.
Absolutely, and yeah. you worked hard for your dad as well. You first started work helping in the family business, delivering coal. Yeah, with your brother Billy.
That's it, yeah.
And then later, while you were a semi-professional entertainer, you were working on the knocker, selling household goods.
Good morning, madam.
Yes.
could I interest you in a bucket of shovel or a bottle of disinfectant?
That's it. So did that give you a lot of good material for your act?
You always meet. Everybody's like, every person you meet is like a book. Everybody's got a story to tell. So going around and talking to all the housewives, and sometimes the men as well, you get a wonderful respect for an audience.
Yeah.
Eye-to-eye contact. It's a very good groundwork to start off with. A lot of some entertainers start off in a show, you know, as an apprentice dancer or singer. But I started going around talking to people and ended up talking to myself as a ventriloquist.
Right, OK. So you turned full-time professional in 1954 with your debut at the Nottingham Empire.
I didn't realise within 10 years, less than 10 years, I was top of the bill at the Palladium.
Yeah, amazing.
All my life I've been so blessed and so wonderfully lucky. I haven't done it on my own. I've always had people to help me.
Yeah.
If it isn't your parents, your lady friends, your agent, your managers, it's very important to remember the team that put you there, you know.
Sure, yeah. So what can you remember of that first night, your first professional gig at the Nottingham Empire?
Oh, Nottingham Empire, yeah.
Yeah.
Top of the bill was Kenny Baker, the trumpeter.
Right.
That's right, Kenny Baker and Kenny Baker's half dozen. All nice lads playing the trumpet, and he asked me would I introduce him.
Okay.
So really, as well as doing I thought I was a comedian.
Right.
I never used to go on as myself. I used to have to hide behind a character. So I was Professor Yaffel Chuckabutty, operatic tenor and sausage knotter. That was me. And and also I compared the show.
Amazing. And you've been touring theatres ever since, all over the UK. Now
I was very, very lucky. In 1954, I just got in at the fag end of the theatre's supremacy. All the big theatres were still there.
Right.
And I played everywhere from Sunderland right up to the House of Terror, Glasgow Empire.
I was going to mention the Glasgow Empire.
Yeah. Birmingham. Down south, I went to Chiswick Empire.
Right.
Finsbury Park Empire, yeah.
So how did you get on at the Glasgow Empire? You didn't do a Des, did you?
No. There's a plaque there saying, Des O'Connor fell here. No, I was terrified, of course.
Yeah.
But I went on the stage with my, in the way I used to appear in those, with my shirt hanging out, and big army boots on.
Right.
This mad professor.
Right.
I think I'd probably influenced by people like Charlie Chaplin, Maxwell.
Yeah.
Anyway, I went on. My first words to a Glasgow audience was, "I suppose you're all wondering why I've sent for you." Oh dear. And the man on the third row sort of slowly uncoiled himself, got to his feet, clutching half a bottle of whiskey, looked at me and he shouted out, "Crepes, what a horrible sight!" And that was my first big, my own laugh. I got a big laugh, and that was it. You know, I just kept going. A Glasgow audience are a wonderful audience. I go there every year now, back to the pavilion.
Right.
But a Glasgow audience will always enjoy your act if you work hard. If you look as though you're working, you've got to look as though you're working.
Yeah.
They won't stand for anybody just standing there and just drawling the gag. No, they won't like that at all.
No, they want their money's worth. Yeah.
You've got to be a visual comic,
right,
as well as a verbal comic.
Okay. Let's talk about the general subject of comedy for a minute. How has comedy changed over the years you've been working?
Right. Well, there are three questions that any interviewer always asks you.
Sorry.
And that's one of them. They say, has humour changed? Where's your favourite theatre? And when are you going to retire? The last one, I think they're hinting.
Right, well, I'm not going to ask you any of the other two, just this one.
Has humour changed?
Yeah.
No. in the 50 or 60 years I've been trying to be a comedian, thankfully, you still learn something every day.
Yep.
I've never done the same show twice, because every audience is different. See, every audience is a permutation of different personalities.
Right.
And you don't do a show at an audience. You don't, like a singer does his sings his song at the audience, whether the, you know, and he doesn't stop whether they like it or not. But a comedian has to do a show with an audience,
right?
Because they let you know after every joke, after every line, they let you know whether they like you or not, or whether they're going to laugh. So we still laugh at the same things now as they did in say, in Shakespeare's time.
Sure.
Men, women, love, sex, marriage, money, power. All the same things we laugh at. It's the audiences that have changed.
Right, yeah.
Because the audiences now, at one time, when in 54, your act had to be absolutely spotlessly clean.
Right.
Even Max Miller never told any dirty jokes, never told a monkey joke.
No.
Max Miller always looked as though he was going to. He always, oh, please, no, laddie, don't make me, no, you mustn't make me say that, laddie. No, you get me into trouble, laddie. He always gave the impression he was going to say something or do something terrible.
Yeah, yeah.
But he never did.
He never got there.
You couldn't be blue on the theatre in those days, because on a Monday night, a group of men used to come in called the Watch Committee.
Right.
Three or four of local worthies. And if you told anything that they didn't like, they'd just send a note round. And if you didn't, if you did it again on the Tuesday, they wouldn't let you appear anymore.
So sure.
You have to keep it reasonably clean.
Yeah, yeah. So what
but
makes
nowadays it's anything goes. You know.
Oh yeah.
A lot of they're not really comedians, but they think they are, and maybe they would be one day when they learn the job properly.
Yeah.
Most of the humour is in the bottom half of the trousers, you know.
Yes, yeah, I agree.
Mentioning the unmentionable.
I agree.
And going where, telling jokes about taboos that are not really supposed to be talked about.
Yeah. So why do we need to laugh? How important is laughter?
Oh, well, it's one of the greatest gift.
Yeah.
The greatest gift you've been given, because it's a wonderful thing. It releases tension, stress. It helps you to get over any disappointments or sadness. Yeah, it's a very, very important human attribute.
Yeah. Now, I know you keep reams and reams of joke books with you, and you go through them. But how much do you ad lib on stage?
Well, quite a lot.
Yeah.
But a good 75% of what I do at one time has been an ad lib.
Right.
You just let your mind freewheel.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Say the first thing that you, after a while you trust. You trust your sense of humour,
right.
And a good ad lib, it's a wonderful feeling. It's like, what can I say, it's like learning to ride a bike.
Okay, well, you had a problem with that when you were a boy, didn't you?
Yes, I fell off. I'm a chopper, I'm a teeth.
Yeah, and that's why you've got the distinctive look you've got today.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Okay, now, a lot has been said about the length of your shows. Why do you have this reputation?
What an ugly rumour. An ugly rumour.
So why do they sometimes go on a tad long?
Well, two reasons.
Yeah.
The first reason is because I enjoy it. I love it.
Yeah.
I'm what they call stage struck.
Right.
I'm stage struck. I love every second I'm on the set. I can't wait to get to Southend and tickle the audience. And the second other reason is because I can.
Yeah.
I've got a mind, a warehouse full of jokes, quips, sayings that I've gathered over the years. And I just want to make everybody else. I've got the best job in the world, you know.
Oh,
I only thought of this the other day.
Yeah.
I only see happy people.
That's great. Yeah, yeah. And you also had enormous success with your music career, didn't you? We played Tears.
Well, at one time, comedians used to finish their act with either a piece of poetry or what you call a jolly, happy, when you're smiling, I want to be happy. But I, for a tryout once, because I was... I love music and I love singing, and I was in the church choir until they found out where the money was, the noise was coming from. But I always loved singing. I thought I'd try out. I'll try a straight song, a ballad.
Yeah.
And and it went very well.
It did. Tears sold over 1.5 million copies and sales.
2 million now.
Oh, really? Is it? Oh, well, sorry, I'm not up to date. But sales figures like that are unheard of today.
And Happiness did very well. Happiness
That's
sold over
right.
a million.
Yep.
And my first big one was 1960, Love Is Like a Violin.
Yes, yes, that's right. But 1965, you beat the Beatles at their own game,
you? I didn't beat the Beatles. I kept them out of the charts.
You did.
Beat them. I kept them. Everybody else was Rolling Stones and the Beatles and all the other pop groups in 54. It was quite the thing, you know, rock and roll. Slow ballad, tears for souvenirs. It kept them out for 18 weeks.
Yeah, great. Well, look, talking of the Beatles, I'd briefly like to take you back to those times. I've got a little piece of audio here for you with you and the boys being interviewed on television. And then I've got a question for you, Ken. Just have a listen to this.
We have always thought that it might be a good question to put to Mr. Kenneth Dodd and the members of the Beatles. To what extent do they attribute their success to their hairstyles?
Do you think that he owes a lot of his success to his hairstyle, fellas?
No, I don't think it helped at all.
Have you no ambitions to form a group yourself?
Love to, with the boys.
Yeah.
Doddy and the Diddy Man.
Yeah, what about yourself?
Yes, I'd like to, yes, because the only thing is I'd have to change my name, you see. I'd have to have a name like Cliff or Rock, something earthy. Let's invite suggestions for an earthy name for me.
Yeah, well, what about that, fella?
Sod.
Oh, I laugh at that every time I hear it. That is such a great line from George.
They had a few minutes to spare.
Yep.
They'd been doing a show at the studios in Manchester, and they had a few minutes to spare. They said, would I like to talk to the Beatles?
Okay.
So I said, yeah, sure, yeah, great. So I went into the where they were talking to, that was Gay Byrne. Like, Gay Byrne was
the
presenter. And he'd been speaking to him, and they just started ad-libbing.
Right.
And the man who said sod...
Yep.
Was?
George Harrison.
Exactly.
Yes. Well, you see, this is
very nice man. He was the musical brains behind the Beatles. Right. He was the only one who could play an instrument.
Really?
The others just held them. It didn't matter because nobody listened to the words anyway. All the girls are still screaming.
Oh,
so you couldn't hear what they did anyway.
That's right. But do I detect the hand of Dodd involved in that joke?
No,
or was
no,
it truly no. ad-libbed?
Oh, no, it was all ad-libbed, but yeah.
Really? That's amazing. Okay, you're off touring the country. You do something like 100,000 miles a year, don't you, touring around?
Yeah.
Is that the hardest part?
Like a human yo-yo. Travelling is the difficult part, you see.
Yeah.
Travelling really takes it out of you, you know?
Yeah, I'm sure. Okay, if you don't mind, Ken, I've got a few questions from listeners for you. Is that all right? Denise Jean Walker asks, Ken Dodd doesn't stop talking at his shows. Where does his energy come from?
from the audience.
Right.
You, an audience, you do your act, and sometimes you don't realise what it's taking out of you, but it's a labour of love.
Yeah.
Talking to the audience and listening to, sometimes you ask them questions and they say all sorts of crazy things to you. So batting them back to them, the audience. The audience give you they give you the what they call a G. They give you the G for getting going, you know.
Yeah, you feed off of that. Okay. Trudy Turner has a very cheeky question. Any tips for paying my next tax bill, Ken?
Yes, indeed, yes. Keep your mouth shut and buy a stamp and get it off to them. it's like dealing with any band of robbers.
Yeah.
Just give them a little bit now and again and keep them quiet.
Okay. Now, Carol hasn't really asked a question. She's just saying that I auditioned to be a Diddy Man when I was at dancing school, but I was half an inch too tall.
Oh
isn't that a shame?
Oh, yes, we had some... When I played pantomime at Wimbledon, we had the lady who supplied the dancers for Diddy Men was Bonnie Langford's mother.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Bonnie Langford, her mother ran a big dancing academy, and she supplied the kids. And they're all lovely kids too. Yeah, yeah. All nice kids from round about London. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah, right.
Right.
Now, one of our own presenters, Michelle Wald, has asked this, Ken. Who has been the most famous celebrity you've tickled with your tickling stick?
Oh, I'd be very honoured. When I was at the Palladium, it was like every night was celebrity night.
Right.
Everybody, Mrs. Thatcher came.
Right.
Mrs. Thatcher with her entourage.
Did you get tickled?
And I stood on the stage, and my first words, I used to come on this, on what they call the Revolve, on a little light blue mini. And I got out of the mini, and I went to this thing and said, by Jove, you know, how tickled we are, how long are we going to have Mrs. Thatcher? I said, isn't it wonderful, Mrs. Thatcher? For the first time, I'm talking and you're listening. And she laughed. She's got a wonderful sense of humour.
Yeah.
And prior to her, I've entertained about five prime ministers.
Yeah.
Jim Callaghan came, Harold Wilson came, Yeah, yeah. I mean, so politicians. Oh well, of course they the big stars from America came over, some to do filming over here, some to be touring Europe, and some to appear on the Royal Show. So I've actually stood on the stage of the Palladium, and I've sung to and at Bing Crosby.
Wow.
Bing Crosby, he came with Phil Harris, and he came backstage, a lovely man, charming man.
Yeah.
Bob Hope came. Bob Hope was wonderful. He was on the Royal Show. A lovely man. Very, the big stars are always marvellous, wonderful people.
Yeah.
Because I think they appreciate the fact, like we all do, anybody who's an entertainer realises it's the best job in the world.
Yeah.
So Bob Hope, Bing Crosby, Danny LaRue was marvellous. Wonderful man, wonderful Danny LaRue.
Fantastic.
120% entertainer.
Right. Okay, one final question from listeners. Nick Bone asked, how did the miners' dispute in the 1980s affect the Jambutty mines of Knotty Ash?
Well, we kept going, you know. The Jambutty mines of Knotty Ash have a great history. They were originally discovered, I think it was in 1600 and tut, by the famous explorer, Sir Dingle Jetty, a man called Sir Dingle Jetty. One day he fell headfirst into a vat of raspberry jam, shouting out the immortal words, heaven preserve us.
Wonderful. Thank you, Ken. So, Ken, one final question. Did you ever think that you'd get to this point in your life and still be performing to sell-out audiences?
I think none of us know what we're going to do during the latter part of your life.
Yeah.
And I'm doing what... A man retires... That was the other question, wasn't it? When you're going to retire. A man retires when he stops doing what he doesn't want to do,
yep,
and starts doing what he does want to do.
Yeah.
So, but I'm doing what I love doing, so therefore it's not really work.
No.
When you think of all the terrible jobs that some people have to do, some of them are dangerous, some of them are dirty, some of them are boring. So I'm really the most blessed man. I used to say lucky, but now I say blessed.
Yeah.
Blessed man in show business. I love the job I'm doing, and I love audiences.
Well, Ken, a long may it continue. It's fantastic. We absolutely love you, and thank you for talking to us today on Phoenix FM.